B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, how about that ending at the Century Tournament of Champions? First, it was Justin Thomas's to win. Then he puts a shot in the junk on 18, and it's Xander Schauffele's to win. And he turns an eagle into a three-putt par and lets Thomas and Patrick Reed, who's been in the clubhouse for an hour, back in for a three-way playoff. Then it's Reed's to win, and Thomas makes a great up and down. And finally, Thomas wins as Reed's putter fails him for the first time all week. Crazy. Crazier still, how brazen golf fans and fans in general have become. There was no mistaking the cry of cheater from the gallery as Reed missed his final putt on 18. Granted, now this is a hole that he's done a good job of digging for himself. But still, we'll talk about Patrick, the Century Tournament of Champions, and more with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. Also today, we'll check in for the first time this year with golf historian Peter Kessler for his thoughts on great golf courses, the President's Cup, Tiger Woods, and some pretty good advice for Patrick Reed. Then we'll wrap things up with a conversation with John Feinstein, whose piece on Reed this week for Golf World is a must read. So let's get started. From Hawaii, my conversation earlier this week with Ron Green Jr.
Hello there.
Well, I'm trying a new strategy with you this year on our conversation in Hawaii. Last year, I made the mistake of calling you later in the day when the sun was setting over the Pacific and you stepped away from your duties to go stand in the ocean and talk to me and even sent me a picture of your view at the time. So I'm hoping that since I'm talking to you in the afternoon and this is early in the morning, at least you're just sitting somewhere in a restaurant having breakfast.
No, I would send you a picture, but it's been cloudy. Winds blowing 30 since I got here last week, and it rains about every 45 minutes.
Oh, well, good. At least you're having some misery.
Yeah. It has been blowing, supposed to blow even more tomorrow.
Ron, before we get to the particulars about the tournament itself, let's get to the important stuff, and that was you playing the Plantation course on the Monday after the tournament, putting your game on display in Hawaii. How did that go?
The best thing that could be said about it, besides the obvious beauty of the place, is three of us played in 3 hours, 2 minutes, carts on path.
That's impressive.
That is impressive. Of course, that's what happens when you have scheduled your flight from Maui to Honolulu a little earlier than you wanted, thinking there was a college football national championship game this past Monday. Last year, I had a late flight and missed the whole thing, so I said, I'm not going to do that again. And, well, I should have checked the schedule. But anyway, had a good time playing. More appreciation than ever for how good these guys are. You know, we did not play the tip-tip, so we played the one setup, which, is still a gracious plenty, and playing in that wind on new greens, it's a great experience if people ever get out that way. It is a bucket list kind of place just because of the beauty, and it's unlike anything else you're ever going to play. I think they said from the tip top up around 17 tee down to the very bottom down around second green, I think it's 500 feet elevation change.
It's got to be that if you're a caddy, and I know that they ferry them a couple of times because there's literally a half mile between a green and a tee box somewhere on that golf course. But if you're a caddy, I know Augusta National is a tough sled. That's got to be the toughest sled on tour, right?
I don't think anything's even close. Yeah, if you've been to Augusta National and think about walking from the 10th tee down to the 10th green on down to Amen Corner,
right,
how big that is. Now, quadruple or quintuple it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about the course in terms of what they kept talking about on TV. I knew that there had been some renovation done, especially to the greens, but I didn't realize they had resodded the entire golf course. And therefore, it appeared to play like it was the year 2000 or 2001 again, where you had, 18 was interesting to see guys actually having to hit three woods trying to get to the green and two, as opposed to the past couple of years when I've seen people hit 7 and 6 iron to get there.
Yeah, I think part of that was just the conditions. They've had a lot of rain, and it rained, I want to say, Thursday night into Friday, because I was supposed to play the Bay course Friday morning, and there was 3 inches of rain in 24 hours there. So you know, even on big slopes, you're not going to get much roll. So it played much longer, and the wind was, you know, pretty severe. So it changed it. They were a little disappointed because, yeah, you're right. Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw came in there and redid the golf course. They really only about three or four tees added, reshaped some of the greens. But, I mean, they took off all the fairway grass out there, stripped the place, took it to sand, and redid it all in a year. It cost almost as much, Ben told us, that to redo it as it did to build it originally. And so they didn't get it quite the way they wanted in terms of weather conditions, but they were pretty happy with it and loved the thought of what it could be going forward.
Ron Greenjew of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. He's in Hawaii. The playoff was really kind of unique in terms of you had some big-name players, a couple of major champions, and the appearance that nobody wanted to win the dang tournament. I don't think I've ever seen stumbling on an 18th hole and in a playoff from that caliber of player as I saw at Kapalua. Was it as stunning in person as it was on TV?
Funny as you ask that question, the winner literally, you may have heard his cleats on the concrete just walk past me. But it was, yeah, I mean, it was, it became pretty theatric there the last hour or so. You know, you sort of thought it was Justin's to win, then you thought it was Xander's to win, and suddenly there's Patrick Reed there, and, you know, and Justin just, you know, that 18th hole kept, you know, he kept hitting shots like you just don't expect to see him hit. And, you know, but he found a way to win. It was strange. I mean, and then, I mean, it was really getting dark. They were already, you know, they said it on television. They were coming back at 8 o'clock the next morning had they not gotten it done right then. But he found a way. You saw guys perplexed. Shoffley, I think, perplexed with a couple putts he hit. Patrick Reed had a putt there at the end that he just was stunned that it did what it did. And, you know, and you were so used to seeing, you know, guys just, you know, attack in playoffs and just, you know, birdie. But it was hard. And, you know, I think the moment had a lot to do with it. And but Justin Thomas got it done.
Patrick Reed is becoming an increasingly fascinating person to me on the PGA Tour, maybe the most fascinating person on the PGA Tour, as I've been trying to rack my brain and find a true anti-hero that the sport has ever had, and I can't think of one. This guy's amazing to me in that part of me admires the hell out of him because of what he's able to do and his focus in the face of the maelstrom he creates for himself on the golf course. But then part of me is just disgusted by all that keeps happening around Patrick Reed on the golf course. If you were giving him a piece of advice, what would you say to Patrick Reed?
Well, I think he could probably do himself some good if he just sat down with whomever or in a group or whatever and maybe just had a whole, almost a mea culpa, like, chat. But that's not, he's not going to do that. It's not who he is. I think he is perfectly at peace with who he is and how he plays. And, you know, and obviously the Bahamas thing just blew up. And then when he's back in contention, you get the heckler bellowing out there and all that. So, I think he's looked at what he's done, where he is and where he's going, and I don't think he's going to change. I think that's he does sort of march to his own beat. He's friendly. I mean, I've talked to him many times, and he's chatty. He'll stop and talk and about all sorts of things and nice and pleasant, and I've talked to guys play with him, and, you know, they like him, and then they see things that happen and just, like, shake their head, like, oh, my gosh. You know, I think the Bahamas thing really bothered people the way he didn't show any remorse for it and seemed, at least initially, like, well, they said it was a penalty, so I'll take the two strokes, when it was obvious to everybody in the world. But, I mean, that's his story, and he's sticking to it. You know, there was a lot made about the heckler yelling cheater on the putt Sunday in the playoff there, and he insists he did not hear that his reaction was looking at his caddy, shocked at what the putt had done. And Justin Thomas said the same thing, said he didn't hear it either. And thought Patrick was looking at his caddy, but, you know, it just added another little layer, another little piece to the story that's out there with him. So I don't know. He'll be fun to watch going forward. I think he doesn't mind if people don't love him. I think he finds a motivation and different things than maybe some other players do. But I think it's just, you know, stay the course for Patrick right now.
Yeah, you know, and like you, all of my dealings with Patrick and Justine, for that matter, have been nothing but pleasant, going back to when I first met them both, when she was toting the bag for him at the Wells Fargo years ago. And, you know, that's another thing that bothers me, and that, you know, there's a part of me that really likes this guy. It's just, it's weird. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. Has there been any conversation about Patrick's caddy laying on the green?
No, I find it a little, you know, I think it's a little much, but that's what they do, you know. I mean, it was one thing when Camilo Villegas got down and did whatever they call that thing, but, you know, that's the way that it works for the caddy. Nobody said anything about it, but you can't help but notice it when he does it.
Yeah, I just keep thinking that if all 120 caddies or 140 caddies did this on Thursday and Friday, can you imagine what the greens would look like by the end of the day? I just think, I keep waiting for the rules officials to step in and say, okay, let's quit this.
Well, you know, a lot of caddies don't even read putts. It just depends. Sometimes players will call them in. Sometimes they don't. You know, like Joey with Tiger. Sometimes when Tiger's not sure, he'll call Joey in. Other times he just does it himself. So, you know, each player caddy dynamic is different in that way.
Ron, I can remember where the course you were at now, Wailea on Oahu, used to be a layup for the players when it was a par 72. In fact, I think I remember John Houston shooting like a 27 or 28 under that was a record for several years at the time. A few years ago, more than a few now, it underwent a big renovation. It's a par 70 now, and it's a tough test of a golf course just in normal conditions. We saw a lot of rain, as you mentioned, at Kapalua on Maui last week. What is the weather like on Oahu, and how will it affect the scoring at Wailea?
What you saw last week is what you're going to see this week, except instead of on a big mountainside golf course, you're going to see it on a flat sort of in-town golf course. I mean, it's supposed to blow 25 to 30 most of the week with rain showers coming in and out. It's this is probably not the Chamber of Commerce Hawaii weather that you would expect. Now, there are going to be beautiful times there, but I mean, it's supposed to be pretty disruptive a little bit. I don't know if it's going to stop play, but I think it will definitely affect the way players play. It'll be harder to just go out and just go full bore at things because the wind's going to be such a factor. Now, a lot of these guys love playing in the wind. I was talking to Webb Simpson yesterday. He said he really loves playing in the wind. He's learned so much more about how to sort of control shots and all that. And so some guys, I think, will embrace it, and I think that's what guys did last week. But here the targets are so different. There's so much, you know, they got fairways at the Kapalua, at the plantation course that I can't miss. But here they got, you know, you got to walk, hit it between the palm trees and all that. So I think it'll be interesting to see. It's not the most star-filled field this week, but, you know, I would expect a lot of the same guys. I think Webb will play well. I think Matt Kuchar, the defending champion, he's a guy who's going to play well. And guys who can be patient and then take advantage of their opportunities. I think it's a good week for those kind of guys.
Not to spend another second on Patrick Reed, but you bring up Webb Simpson, and that reminds me. Have you had a chance to talk with him about what it was like to be Patrick's partner in the middle of all of that going on in Australia and how it affected him?
Yeah, I mean, he said it was pretty rough. It was, you know, there was a lot going on. I mean, it was... You know, he likes those team events, and Webb said he doesn't mind it. You know, that's part of what you get when you get into those. This one, a lot of guys said maybe got a little over aggressive at times, but it's just, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there to hear it, but yeah, it became an issue. And I mean, obviously, with what Patrick's caddy did, I mean, just a reaction to the frustration there. But yeah, I think, you know, I think before they got to Australia, I think Webb and Patrick knew they were playing together, and that had been decided. And then, you know, they played okay. They didn't play great, but it was not a surprise to them when they, you know, were sent to the first tee together.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. Champion last week was Justin Thomas. It's the second time he's won Kapalua. He, to me, is the sneakiest 12-time winner on the PGA Tour. He's got 12 wins. He's got a major championship, a couple of WGCs. Has it been as sneaky to you as it was to me? When they flashed that on the screen last weekend, I went, God, that's happened fast.
I think it's happened fast. I don't think it's sneaky because I think he's right up there. I mean, he's in the discussion with Rory and Tiger and Brooks when you're talking about the best players in the world. You know, for so long, he sort of seemed to be in Jordan Spieth's shadow, and now it's gone around the other way. And I mean, I think, I mean, he said frustration to him is that he's only won 12 times. He said, I'm not trying to diminish what I've done, but he said, I should have won a lot more often than that. And I think that's, I think he's a guy who could run it out there and win a whole lot. I mean, just a whole lot. We're always talking about who's going to have the big year. Well, he's as primed as anybody to have the really big year. I mean, where couldn't he win a golf tournament? I just think he, you know, the way he plays, I mean, he's a great player any age, but he's sort of the quintessential modern player and has such confidence and, you know, managed to shake off what was happening to him Sunday in the playoff and move forward and, you know, not let it just, you know, sap all the energy and confidence out of him. He just kept going, and look what it wound up giving him.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And when we return, golf historian Peter Kessler takes dead aim at timeless golf courses, Tiger Woods, Patrick Reed, and more. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Golf historian Peter Kessler's opinions are those that you may not agree with 100% of the time, but they're always well thought through, thought-provoking, and always welcome on this show.
Well, Peter, it's funny, I watch golf throughout the fall and the holidays, and I have a little file on my phone called Notes to Talk to Peter About, and when they get full up, I'm like, okay, I got to call him. Enough's enough. We haven't spoken in some time, and I want to pick your brain on several topics. I want to start with what I consider to be the two huge highlights for me last year in the golf season, and they happen to be two golf courses. I don't know how we could do it. We probably can't, but is there some way we can find reason to put professional golf and the finest golfers in the world at Royal Portrush and at Royal Melbourne every year? Those two golf courses, with all the talk about equipment and outdating golf courses, these two venerable golf courses withstood the best in the world and seem to withstand the test of time as they require shot making. And with both courses, and I think you and I may have corresponded on this, as I watched them, all I could think was, I want to play those. And that's the mark of a truly great course, yes?
Oh, no question about it. And actually, that's what kept you watching. You know, now, it happened to also be true that the golf turned out to be terrific. The matches turned out to be great. And the Open Championship turned out to be great. And so you were happy to watch. But it was a lot more fun because we appreciated what we were looking at. And it points out, of course, that inland courses or parkland courses, as they're sometimes called, generally appear less attractive on camera. There's just no question about it because you don't have the natural elements. You don't have the wind. You know that the wind, if there is some, isn't coming from the ocean. You look at the course. Now, here's a good example of a course on the water that didn't look attractive, which was Kapalua. Now, this is a good golf course. It's too easy for the golf professionals, and Coore and Crenshaw toughened it up. But it doesn't look good on television. It does look much better in person. But that's right, Royal Melbourne and Portrush were absolutely sensational. Particularly, I thought, Royal Melbourne, just because even though the equipment was, you know, completely ill-suited for that golf course, they had too many par fours they could drive. There were too many par fours that they could leave a short chip. There were too many par fours where you just had a little pitch. And so it took away from, you know, what's really essentially missing in the golf game today, which is guys hitting five irons from awkward angles over a greenside bunker they'd rather not try to go over, to a green that slopes the other way. Now, recreational players have 5-iron shots from awkward angles every time they play a round of golf. So for us, it hasn't changed. But without the 5-iron recovery shot, you'd have never heard of Hagen or Palmer or Seve or Phil or Tiger, for that matter, because the recreational player can't hit that shot. He can't hit the 5-iron from 190 or 200 from an awkward angle. But everybody can hit a shot at a deep rough 5 yards to the side to put it back into the fairway, including somebody who learned to play golf last week. So having rough to counteract the distance the ball goes is a non-starter, because anybody can play a 5-yard shot laterally, again, including anybody who just started the game. So Royal Melbourne would have been really great if they were playing with clubs that suited the field. Even so, it's such a fantastic course. You knew you would play it every day for the rest of your life and never feel like you ever missed anything in golf just from watching on television.
One thing about Royal Melbourne, and it's become something that as I travel around and I play different golf courses that I've become very keenly aware of, my pet peeve in the game of golf, and again, it's because architects have had to build these monstrosities to withstand equipment, is I just don't think you need to have a 227-yard par 3 for it to be a good par 3. And to see a 150-yard par 3, 157-yard par 3 absolutely vex the greatest players in the world is great. There's a par 3 coming up at LA North. You and I both know. You'll know the whole number. I do not. But I remember watching it in the Walker Cup a couple of years ago. It plays like 100 yards, and it's going to bedevil those guys in the U.S. Open. If you have a course that has great par 3s, chances are the rest of your course is great as well.
Now, if you go ahead and extrapolate what you just said to the next stage, what you then conclude is, isn't it interesting how the best holes at any golf tournament, whether it's a major championship or a regular event, is a par 3, because that's the only hole 4 times around where the folks who set up the 4 par 3s can actually manage the approach shot distance and difficulty for everybody. And so even though some guys are longer and shorter than others, par 3 is the only way that a course can defend itself against the ridiculous distances the drivers go and the weak pitches that are left. And if you watch the major championships the way in which you and I did, and you watch what happened at Royal Melbourne, one thing that you noticed was all the par 3s play into a different direction, and all 4 shots that you hit were hit with different clubs. Only 4 holes on a golf course at the pro game where that occurs anymore, where for us, it's true for all 18 holes, and it always will be.
One more thing about Royal Melbourne and the President's Cup, and I'm going to beat this dead horse a couple of times, but I feel like if I don't, and if you don't, and if other people don't, we're going to forget about it when he's gone. Once again, in my lifetime, I've never seen an iron player the likes of Tiger Woods. And the iron display that he put on at Royal Melbourne for the keen observer, where he was putting the ball, where he was eliminating sides of the golf course and portions of the green, he was just in charge of his game, and it was head and shoulders better than anyone else on that golf course. And there were some really great golfers on that golf course, but when he is still on, he's the finest there is.
Oh, he's the greatest iron player arguably ever. Now, you know, we didn't get to watch Jones and Barden and Hogan, you know, hit their shots. We have anecdotal evidence. I've got an extraordinary amount of that. And we have the record itself. But yes, the greatest iron player we've ever seen. And the reason why it was so good at Royal Melbourne, to be very, very, very specific, is it's because it's the same move that he used in my mind's eye and in my memory at 2000 at Pebble. Everything was a 3/4 iron shot. He never tried to jump on it, and that's what's hurt him in recent years, jumping on a driver early and getting in trouble at a major championship and never getting out of trouble. The golf he played at Royal Melbourne was, in terms of the swing, in terms of the shots, all of the things that you successfully described so accurately, was as good as I've seen. And yes, best iron player ever. He can pick any shot that he wants to hit at any time. He always picks the right one. He never leaves himself in trouble unless he makes a physical error. But yes, you know, when Tiger was the best player in the world, he was obviously the best iron player in the world. He may not be the best ranked player in the world right now. But there's nobody I'd rather have hit my irons for me coming down the back nine of a major championship against anybody else in golf right this minute other than Tiger Woods.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim, which leads me to Kapalua. And there's lots to discuss about Kapalua, but I want to start at the end with the playoff. And this is another reason why Tiger spoiled us. I can never remember an occasion where Tiger would have been in the position that Justin Thomas was, where he has a one-shot lead on the 18th hole, and it's a par 5, or it's a par 4, or it's a par 20. I don't care what it was. And Tiger didn't pull off the shots you were supposed to pull off with a one-stroke lead to close the tournament. People, and JT is a marvelous golfer. He's won 12 times on the tour. He's a major champion. At the rate he's going, he's probably going to end up in the Hall of Fame. I get that. But we see golfers at the top level right now who are prone to mistakes that for the better part of 20 years, we just weren't used to seeing golfers make. And this is another thing that Tiger did and that Tiger was that I hope is not lost on people's attentions and lost by time, because it's truly amazing.
Well, because there's also been very few guys really over the course of history who've actually been able to do that. That's another reason we're spoiled, is because we went from this period where from June of 1962 through the championships of 1980, the majors of which Jack won two that year at the age of 40. So we were spoiled for that whole time period about the way in which Jack Nicklaus always closed, Gary Player always closed, Billy Casper always closed, Arnold did not always close, but you could count on the great players to do what they were supposed to do when they were supposed to do it. And that's why there's so few guys who won five or more major championships over time. It's an incredibly small number still. And that's because there's really very few guys who deep down want the ball on the 18th tee. I mean, the number of disasters that we've seen from, well, take a marginal player. Remember Robert Garrigues had a three-shot lead a few years ago, and it was the famous round where the humidity was so bad that it looked like he'd had accidents in his trousers and stuff, and it was a pretty unattractive scene. And Lee Westwood was already on his way to the airport, and he'd only won one time in this country, and that day he would win for his second and last time. Lee Westwood, two U.S. PGA Tour victories in his whole life. Are you kidding me? So that means between he and Colin Montgomery, they had two PGA wins their whole life. So Garris gets up there, makes his seven, goes into the playoff, and loses it. That's much more likely to happen than it is for us to see a Tiger-esque close. And that's one of the reasons a guy like Brooks Koepka is catching on among people who really understand the way in which successful players play the game at critical moments. You know, the two most important things to evidence that you were one of the all-time great players is, one, you have to win a whole bunch of major championships, and two, you've got to be in contention to go ahead and win those major championships. Jack Nicklaus, 1971 through 1980, take the actual decade as opposed to the 70s themselves. So you go 71 through 80, Nicklaus played 40 majors then, and he had 9 wins, and he had 8 seconds. So he had 17 top twos and 40 majors, and obviously finished in the top 10 of all the rest of them. We're very close there too, obviously, which doesn't matter. But he had 17 top twos. So that, you know, that's what you talk about winning majors, and that's what you talk about being in contention to win majors, which is why I only think the top threes are relevant, because a top three generally means that you probably had a chance to win the golf tournament. Top five doesn't mean that at all. And I think there's a huge difference, and I don't think you should say any had three top five. I don't think that counts. Top threes are better no matter what the event is, to me, is the only thing that actually counts. And so when you look at what's going on in the world of golf today, you see very few guys who can do what Tiger did on holes 11 through 18 at the Masters, for example, which is a significantly more important than a C event in Kapalua. And it just shows you the fragility of very good players relative to the lack of fragility among the truly great players. So we know JT's a good player. Yep, he's won a dozen times. That's a super amount in your early 20s. Yes, he has a major championship, but in no way has he evidenced that he has what it takes inside of him to be a Jack or Tiger at this point. Why Rory doesn't get the attention that he thinks he deserves, because he's a question mark with regard to his ability to close, his ability to stay on an even keel, his ability to get into contention and then not get all unnervy about it and throw it away with a couple of slop house bogeys. So that's why there's very few guys who can close, because there's very few guys who evidence the numbers over an entire career that say he really was a closer. And to me, that's the five majors or more guys.
Get you out of here on this. Peter Kessler, golf historian, our guest taking Dead Aim. If you were to be advising Patrick Reed, what would you tell him?
I would tell him to not do anything proactively at this point other than, you know, having a double check with his moral code. I mean, the first thing he has to do, you know, is have a little visit with himself and make sure that he understands what's expected of him by human decency, by golf manners, by playing, the integrity of playing in golf tournaments, the integrity of playing in professional events. He has to be able to convince himself that he can never again evidence any behavior that you would deem to be questionable in the playing of the game or the way he interacts with the other guys. And so you start that now. You know, it's my mom used to say every time I get kicked out of school, she said, "Oh, that's okay. You'll start a new leaf at the new one." And that's what he can start the new leaf today. You don't have to, like, wait to do that. Then the other thing is, the first time he got interviewed after a round, I wouldn't ask to call a conference. The first time he gets interviewed after a round, I would say to him to say, you know, I've been giving an incredible amount of thought to really my entire career in golf. And when I look back, there are several moments that I'm not proud of, and there are several moments that could have clearly been avoided had I been a better job about being straight with the game of golf and straight with my playing companions and straight with my playing opponents. And you can count on, from this point going forward, that you will find that I will embody everything that the Bob Jones Award stands for. It's the highest award in golf, and it means two things specifically. It means that you've conducted yourself in the highest manner as you can as a golfer. It also means you've conducted yourself in the highest manner as a man, as a human being, off of the golf course. And if he could say that, he could turn the whole thing around and get a fresh start from everybody.
Always nice to get the thoughts of golf historian Peter Kessler. And up next, John Feinstein joins us to take Dead Aim at a piece he's done for Golf World this week. His subject, Patrick Reed, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. John Feinstein is one of the most prolific nonfiction writers in the game of golf over the last three decades. His piece this week in Golf World on Patrick Reed is excellent, and we got the chance to speak on it earlier this week. John, in the beginning of your piece, you reference a scene from The West Wing where Rob Lowe's character proclaims, I'm really a good guy, I'm just having a bad day. And I chuckled out loud because this is so appropriate concerning my feelings about Patrick Reed, as without fail, over the last 5 or 6 years, not just once or twice, but every single time I've had a dealing with him or I've had a dealing with Justine, it's been nothing but pleasant. It's been great. So as far as these things go,
I like the guy, and that's why it bothers me so much.
Well, that's been my experience with Patrick, Charlie. And, you know, in some ways, Patrick's the little girl with the curl. When he's good, he's just wonderful. When he's bad, he's bad. I mean, I think, as I went on to say in the piece, he's made some mistakes. I mean, he did not handle the situation in the Bahamas well. He should have said, I made a mistake. I understand why people might have thought I was cheating. And he did sort of say that. He said it was a camera angle, and looking at the camera angle, he understood why Slugger White had to penalize him. But there have been, the outburst about not playing with Jordan Spieth in the Ryder Cup in 2018. I can't say last year anymore. And you know, when he made the crack to the rules official about, if I was Jordan Spieth, you'd give me a drop here. Those are moments that you got to walk back from. And you know, having been married twice now for a total of 28 years, I've learned how to say, I'm sorry, I screwed up. Sometimes even when I don't think I screwed up. Patrick is, at heart, he's a good guy. He tends to be blunt. And see, here's the thing. One of the things I like about him is that he's blunt. When he made the comment, what was it, back in 2014, after he won at Doral and he won 3 times in 8 months, he said, I think I'm one of the best 5 players in the world right now. I love that, okay? We need more of that and less of golfers just thanking all the volunteers and the sponsors and yada, yada, yada. And a lot of my colleagues who cover golf on a regular basis were, like, insulted. Oh, how dare he? He's ranked 20th in the world. And, of course, the official golf rankings are almost as flawed as the FedEx Cup point system. Not quite. But the point is, when a guy is being honest that way, I like it. A lot of my colleagues who cover golf, they just want to hear Tiger Woods say pablum. And Phil Mickelson, say pablum. I like guys who tell the truth.
You know, why is that, John? Because I've noticed that, too. All we do is beg and plead for candor and transparency from athletes. But it never fails. The ones that give it take more guff for being that way than not.
Which is why they, very good point. And I'll give you a prime example. Rory McIlroy is one of those athletes who always just tells you what he thinks. He does it one-on-one. He does it in press conferences. He does it to be self-deprecating sometimes and sometimes not. And I had in 2016, you might remember, Rory had a press conference at the British Open. This was during the whole thing about guys playing in the Olympics or not playing in the Olympics. And there was the problem, with what was going on. I can't even remember the name of the disease.
The Zika virus.
There you go. I'm glad you remember. Guys were worried about that, especially guys who wanted to have children, which Rory does. And other guys just didn't want to go. The schedule was bad. The Olympics were not a big deal. You know, the tour is selling the Olympics, like it's the biggest thing in the history of the world, which they do with the Players' Championship, for example. And Rory sat down at a press conference and said, look, I thought about it a lot, and I just decided right now this isn't the right thing for me to do. I'm not saying I won't play in Tokyo, but I'm not going. And somebody said something to him. Somebody asked him the question, do you think you'll watch the Olympics? And Rory said, yeah, I'll watch the Olympics, but I'm going to watch the sports that really matter, like swimming, like track and field. He might have said basketball. I don't remember. But he didn't say golf. And the golf media went crazy. And I remember Brandel Chamblee, who's a friend and a former colleague, saying on the air, because I was watching at home, that when Rory McIlroy's career is over, he's going to regret that press conference more than anything in his career. And I texted Brandel right at that moment, and I said, do you think he might regret blowing a 4-shot lead at the Masters on Sunday a little more than that?
I was gonna
Among
say,
other things.
There's a duck hook into the cabins on number 10 that I think he'll
exactly.
look back on a little more.
Exactly. But I had dinner with Rory not long after that. I consider Rory a friend. And we were talking about this, and Rory said, because it wasn't just Brandel. I mean, it's the whole golf media that went crazy. Oh, how can he say golf doesn't matter? And well, golf doesn't matter in the Olympics. Neither does tennis, by the way. My theory on the Olympics is, and I feel this way more and more about basketball, is if the Olympics aren't the most important thing in your sport, they shouldn't be in the Olympics. And I think hockey should be in the Olympics because to everybody but the North Americans, the Olympics are bigger than the Stanley Cup. But my point was, so I said to Rory, you know, how did you react to that? And, you know, he laughed and he said he understood and he likes Brandel and we talked. He said, but you know what? I worry I'm going to get to a point where I'm just going to give the guys he didn't use the word pablum, but, you know, cliches.
Ugh.
Because I get tired of getting ripped for telling the truth. And frankly, I wouldn't blame him.
No.
And I feel the same way about Patrick Reed.
John Feinstein written a brilliant piece about Patrick Reed in Golf World. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. In thinking about Patrick, I think about my mother, who, when she would ask me about the kind of people I was associating with, she always would talk about, well, take him as a whole. What is his pattern? If it walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it's a
right.
duck. And so using my mother's method of analyzing people, I've just made a list off the top of my head. He signs an incorrect scorecard at qualifying at Georgia. And comes out on the wrong end of the discussion there, gets booted. Wins two national titles, but not one friend at Augusta State. Somewhere along the line, turns pro, marries Justine, has bitter fallout with his family. It's none of our business, but apparently golf people think it is. Ryder
right.
Cup at Glen Eagles, you already brought that up. He wasn't paired with Spieth. He was vocal about it.
Yeah, it was the Ryder Cup in Paris.
Or Paris, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The incident in the Bahamas. At Tigers, and you referenced that. We haven't even gotten to the caddy tackling people at the President's Cup. I mean, there's just a lot of smoke around this guy.
Yep.
And you bring up the fact that he's not contrite. Sports fans in this country, more than anything, love someone who screws up, is contrite, and can be given a second chance. He appears to have missed out on the contrition gene in the DNA buffet.
Yeah, I can't argue with that, and that's why I said at the end of the piece I thought it would be good if he brought in somebody from the outside to give him some advice on how to handle publicity. Because, look, Justine is his wife. She loves him. She's going to think that he's right. And she's going to tell him that he's right. I'm sure the same is true of Kessler, who's his brother-in-law and his caddy. He's not going to say, you screwed up, pal. I don't think. He needs an outsider. And I was having a conversation with Tim West, and I don't know if you know Tim, but he's run the Monday Pro-Ams out on the tour for 25 years and been involved in, you know, corporate sponsorships, you know, getting guys to come talk to corporate guys at tournaments. And he knows everybody. I mean, nobody knows more people on the tour than Tim. And Tim is very PR savvy. And he, like me, he likes Patrick Reed a lot. And we had a text exchange this week where I said to him, you should go to Patrick and say, hire me as a consultant. You need somebody like me. And I believe that would be great for Patrick to have somebody, because, you know, if Tim's going to tell Patrick the truth, he's not going to tell him what he thinks he wants to hear. And he needs somebody like that, who, if Patrick says, I disagree with you, you're fired, Tim just goes, fine, I'm good. You know, when guys are afraid to lose their jobs for telling the truth, it doesn't work out too well most of the time. Look at the people around Tiger Woods as an example through the years. But that's what I think Patrick needs more than anything, because Patrick's a bright guy. He has a great heart. He wants to do the right things. Some people have said he doesn't care what people think of him. I disagree with that.
I think we all do. I think he
loved being Captain America.
Absolutely.
Loved it. And in fact, I you know, because I did the book on the 2016 Ryder Cup, the first major, and when I was talking to him after the Ryder Cup, frankly, I hadn't heard the nickname yet. I missed it somehow. I was there at Hazeltine. But I had missed it, and he said something about his nickname. And I said, well, what's your nickname? He said, dude, you haven't heard? It's Captain America. And I laughed, and you could tell he was just thrilled by that. And he is, you know, in our discussions for the book, he mentioned that Mickelson in 2014 at Glen Eagles, when he sat in front of the team on Saturday night and told everybody, you know, why he liked them and what he thought of them, and it was the whole anti-Tom Watson thing with Phil. And Phil said to Patrick, we need to know you better, because you're going to play on a lot of these teams. And Patrick said, look, he made a good point. I tend to go out on the range and put on my headphones and listen to music, and the only time I take them off is to talk to Justine or my swing coach or Kessler. And guys, I know that makes me seem unapproachable to a lot of the guys. So he's aware of it, and he's capable of figuring it out, but he needs somebody to tell him, you need to figure this out, because it doesn't affect his play. We know that. I mean, everybody, I was walking with he and Rory in 2018, the last day of the Masters, and it was completely the opposite of the Ryder Cup. At the Ryder Cup, everybody was for Reed because, you know, USA, USA. But when it was Rory versus Patrick and no countries involved, 90% of the crowd was for Rory. And did it bother him? No, he won by 3 shots.
John Feinstein is our guest taking Dead Aim. He's written a great piece on Patrick Reed for Golf World. There's guys that we've rooted against in golf. Monty immediately comes to mind. But that's a lot different than what's going on with Patrick. The closest thing to Patrick I can think of, and really it was just one incident, is Vijay Singh, who was never showed, in my opinion or in my study, never showed any contrition over what happened in the Caribbean playing golf where, you know, he apparently had a cheating incident. He never showed any contrition over that.
It was actually on the Eurasian Tour.
The Eurasian Tour. You know, and that's the closest thing to this, but... But he's almost a literary anti-hero at this point, isn't he?
Yeah, he really is. The interesting thing in your analogy there is Vijay was never friendly to the media. And Patrick, generally speaking, is not friendly to the media. There's a few people, and I happen to be lucky enough to be one of them, that he does trust and he does talk to and he will take time to talk to. He has never once turned me down when I've wanted to talk to him. Vijay, I'm not sure Vijay even had one or two people like that. Although, one of the best compliments I ever got paid, this is sort of off the topic, but bear with me. When the whole thing happened with the drug thing, where Vijay had taken a drug that had been banned by the PGA Tour.
The deer antler spray or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And he sued the tour because they initially suspended him and then they took back the suspension. And I was asked by Golf Channel to do a piece on the whole controversy. And I went around, talked to a bunch of players, and most of the players were angry with Vijay because they felt like he was suing them, which in effect he was. And finally, the last thing you do in a situation like that is you go to the guy. And I went to Vijay, and I said, hey, I'm doing a piece for Golf Channel, blah, 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 blah. And he looked at me, he said, bro, you know I'm not going to talk to you on camera about that. I said, I understand, but you know I had to ask you. And he said, yeah, I get it. No problem. We shook hands. He gets on a cart to go up to the clubhouse from the 18th hole. And as the cart's pulling away, he yells back at me. He says, hey, keep writing those golf books. They're really good. It was the greatest blow off I ever got in my career. But Vijay and Patrick had that in common in that they've never gone out of their way to court the media. Now, it's interesting that in his comeback, Tiger, although he still doesn't sit down with anybody one-on-one, you know, because God forbid, in his press conferences, he smiles more. He calls people by names or nicknames, you know. I mean, I guarantee you all those golf writers who get called by name in a press conference by Tiger feel like they're 10 feet tall. So they're all, oh, Tiger's the greatest guy that ever lived. No, he's not. He's the same guy. But he's just doing a better job of PR. Patrick has never done that.
Get you out of here on this. You mentioned that Patrick Reed needs somebody to sort of advise him. It's been suggested earlier today on the show that perhaps that person could be in the form of, you know, one of these old grizzled caddies who's been around forever, sort of a Yoda figure with him on the bag. And not just to be with him on the bag, but to be with him. Okay, we've just got done with this. You're about to go into the press room. This is what you need to do. This is what you need to avoid. Could you see him making that kind of move, or is he locked into the brother-in-law?
I think he's locked into the brother-in-law as his caddy. But I know a lot of caddies. I'm friends with a lot of caddies. I would not hire a caddy, any caddy, except maybe Jim McKay, who was always great, you know, with the media and now is part of the media. As a media advisor, marketing advisor, I would hire a professional. Patrick can afford it. I mentioned Tim West. I think he'd be an example. I don't mean an agent, because agents basically their job is to lie. I mean somebody. It could be a retired reporter, even. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if Dan Jenkins were still alive, or any of the guys who no longer cover the tour full time but are still around, there are a lot of them. And somebody who understands the media to say, you need to do this, you need to do that, or you need to not do this. But he does need somebody in his ear who, and it literally isn't part of his family. But it should be a professional, not a caddy.
I commend his piece on Patrick Reed this week in Golf World to you. That's John Feinstein. I'd also like to thank golf historian Peter Kessler and Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studio, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now, links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Before I check out this week, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the passing of an icon. If Pete Dye had only created Harbortown, TPC Sawgrass, and Kiowa's Ocean Course, that would be a Hall of Fame resume. But he created so much more and really put his own unique stamp on our game, along with his late wife Alice, through his unique and inventive architecture. He was a mentor to many, and his courses at times a thorn in all of our sides. Rest in peace, Pete Dye. You were one of a kind. Golf architecture icon, gone after a life well lived at 94. Weather-wise, well, you're going to have to dodge some water here and there, but it seems that's the way we roll in January and February here in the Carolinas. Still unseasonably warm, though, and that means plenty of opportunities for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.